Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
On this week's program, we're talking about energy, highlighting the governor's newly released Clean Energy Action Plan, and getting perspectives on energy policy from the Senate's Energy Committee Chair and an energy expert from the German government. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Governor Tim Walz, DFL leaders, and business representatives held a press conference recently to announce the completion of a framework to move Minnesota toward net zero carbon emissions. The six-point action plan includes goals such as increasing sustainable transportation, improving building efficiency, supporting more resilient landscapes and water management, and promoting economic opportunities that will lead to a carbon-neutral economy.
We understand what can be achieved when we work together, and we believe in the power of collective action, which is why we applaud the Climate Action Framework being launched today as a thoughtful effort to guide the future of climate action. The plan draws upon both the public and private sectors to accomplish its goals. Frankly, there is no other way to meet the urgency of the moment, and we see a role for every government, business, and citizen in creating a resilient and carbon-neutral future.
It was in 2007 where Minnesota was ahead of the rest of the nation. We stepped out front on some of our renewable standards. We stepped out front in a bipartisan manner to talk about how we can protect the pristine environment of this state, at the same time growing the economy. It is a false choice to believe that if you address climate change, that is somehow detrimental to the economy. Nothing could be further from the truth. To not address climate change will be that existential threat to the health, to the well-being, and to the economic future of Minnesotans for generations to come.
Climate change is one of the greatest threats we have to Minnesota's future. None of us want to see the loss of our walleye or our maple trees, and we all have a responsibility to be part of the solution. It's not going to happen if we don't take action at a policy level, but we also need for individual citizens and corporations to be part of the solution.
The Climate Action Framework builds on years of engagement with Minnesotans on this issue. It reflects input from thousands of people and experts around the state, from local government, from tribal nations, from nonprofits, from businesses, and those from sectors across our economy. And we heard from people across the state that Minnesota needs a clear plan to guide how we will reduce and prepare for the impacts of climate change.
Minnesotans understand the urgency of climate change and are ready to act. And they want us to do so by working together, cross-functionally, cross-sectors. From our farmers hit by drought and weather disasters to Minnesota families and businesses and communities whose health and well-being are being threatened by this worsening problem. They're looking for leadership.
Governor Walz's climate change subcabinet is putting forward an ambitious goal of achieving a 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 and net zero emissions by 2050. Getting there will require efforts in all sectors, including policy changes. Joining me now is the chair of the Senate Committee on Energy, Senator David Senjum. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be here, Shannon, as always.
Among all senators, you have the most experience in working with energy policy, and you have led efforts to move Minnesota forward in providing both reliable and renewable energy generation. Is the governor's call for 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030, net zero by 2050, realistic?
I think it's the goal that you need to work towards. Whether or not when 2030 comes or 2050, if we're not quite there, whatever it is, but it's aspirational, and I think it's good to be aspirational in these areas at this time, because we know that we're on this journey, and this journey will certainly take, you know, some level of thought, some level of change. Change is always difficult, but I think we're on our way. We're doing good things now. I think we'll continue to do good things. I think Governor Walz's initiative here is an important one, and irrespective of the election, I think that will carry over. We're just on this journey, and I think we're going to get there.
Last session, you were debating a bill in the Senate that would have lifted the moratorium on nuclear power. You said, and I quote, "Wind and solar are coming along, but they are just a small portion of what is on the menu right now. To achieve the ambitious net zero goal, what do future policymakers need to do?
Well, I think we need to add nuclear power to our menu. I mean, the small modular reactors now, they sort of package them in 50 megawatt pieces, if you will, and you can buy those. They're much safer than, if you will, the former large nuclear power plants. So I think they need to be part of the menu. We talk about baseload. We also, though, need to spend a lot of money. And by the way, Minnesota is way, I think, out ahead of many states in terms of energy storage and in respect to hydrogen, ammonia. I think there's we're doing research here, which is cutting edge in the world, frankly, out the University of Minnesota Morris. We have a lot of good things going for, but we're gonna need reliance. There's no question about that. People will demand that. So how do you take all that wind and solar and let it work for you when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining? You have to have storage, and I think you have to have some level of nuclear power in this mix as well. And by the way, it's clean. It's clean. That, you know, we can talk about the nuclear waste and so on. We can manage that.
So just a little bit more on nuclear power then, because the Senate passed a bill that would have allowed the Public Utilities Commission to consider options for small nuclear power production. In your view, what will be the percentage that could be fulfilled in Minnesota in coming years if we were to move in the nuclear direction? Like, what percentage do you think ideally we should rely on for nuclear?
I think wind and solar will dominate because of just a price. I think that the amount will be basically what we need for assurance relative to reliability. So it's hard to put a percent on there. I could say 20% or something like that, but it's really difficult at this time. It's we're all in the very fluctuating kind of thought process right now. But I just think. The reliance on some level of baseload power is important, and you know, we have some hydro, just tiny bit of it coming from Canada. We need just a little bit more reliance than wind and solar can give us.
So, in your view, though, it is a key component.
Yeah, I think it needs to be part. We talk about the full menu and incorporating all of that together, and I think nuclear power has to be part of our future forward.
Now, when we started, we were talking about Governor Walz, 2030, 2050, and policymakers, of course, can establish these lofty goals. But how do you incentivize a move towards net zero emissions? Because policymakers are not going to be generating this power. It has to be utility companies that generate the power. So how do you incentivize this?
I think about Germany a lot and how they've incentivized themselves, and frankly, in many respects, more recently, it's been the young people that said, we want you, Dad and Mom, take better care of our Earth, and so that's one level of incentive. But right now, with the federal infrastructure bill and the more recent Inflation Reduction Act bill, there is a lot of money coming to states, and frankly, even to people. I think there is the possibility of $8,000 worth of grant money available for electrifying houses, for instance, and so this is all going to unfold in the next couple of years. There's going to be those kind of incentives and probably more that kind of come along here.
Now, you are not currently, but you have been in the past, a member of the Transportation Committee, and a key aspect to net zero emissions has to do with vehicles. Critical to this is not only sufficient charging stations, but improvements in battery life and storage capabilities. Mining is key to battery production. Mining is controversial. What is the path for policymakers to walk this line?
I think, like all of us, we understand when we learn. And I'm personally convinced that you can put the engineering controls, you can put the oversight on the mining activity together in such a way that you can do this, that you can mine the critical minerals and that you can preserve, if you will, the earth at the same time. I'm just dead confident you can do that. We do it all the time, frankly, in our in our food processing plants and things, you know, every place that we want to really guarantee safety, we have that oversight component and we, you know, the checks and balances between government and the private sector. I think we can do it in mining too.
You've been active for many years in partnerships with Germany, and it pertains, as it pertains, to clean energy, and you mentioned it just a moment ago. So Germany is now facing a very serious energy crisis because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Are there crucial lessons that we here in the United States should learn from what is happening there?
Well, I think it's just, again, diversify your power supply, but move forward. And the German people are just a marvelous group of people over there. And what I really admire about them right now, they're going through really, and will be going through some really hard times. In our country, I think if you ask people to go through those kind of difficulties, it would be, there would perhaps be a bit of a political uproar. We don't see that in Germany. I think we see some stability. They're handling it just perfectly in my mind. They understand what their problems are, but they're out, you know, working very, very hard to solve them. And the country's not in chaos, and I don't think it will be. They will move forward in a typical German sort of way towards the future.
Senator David Senjum, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon.
The U.S.-Germany Climate and Energy Summit takes place this week in Pennsylvania. Dr. Florian Knobloch, a member of Germany's Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Climate Action, is visiting with lawmakers here in Minnesota on his way to that event. He joins me to provide a more global perspective on the transition to clean energy. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Germany is often recognized as a leader in clean energy, and Minnesota has a history of partnership when it comes to searching for clean energy solutions. From your perspective, what does Germany do well?
So there are two answers to that. So first part is, I think we started perhaps a bit earlier than others to look into renewables. So we tried to do our homework to transition towards renewable electricity first and now to decarbonize our whole economy, essentially. But I think what's much more crucial, since Germany is only a tiny part of the whole world, and our emissions only account for like 2% of global emissions, from the beginning we made sure to cooperate with others, with people in Minnesota, for example, around the world, to spread the word, to share knowledge, to have an exchange of opinions and experiences on how we can proceed with the energy transition. So it's really great seeing how this is going along here in Minnesota and how we are all working on that together. So really that spirit of cooperation, that's really the key, I think.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has led to an energy crisis throughout Europe and prompted a directional change in nuclear energy policy in Germany. Germany had been poised to become the first nuclear-free industrial power, but now will keep two plants operational for the time being. Will Russia's actions change the calculus on nuclear-powered energy in Germany?
Well, we are facing difficult times in Germany right now due to Russia's war of aggression on Ukraine, and it will be tough to get through the winter. But let me be clear on that. Our targets regarding decarbonization, renewable energy, phasing out nuclear as well as coal remain in place. Still, we're forced to make some pragmatic decisions in the short term. Right now, for the winter, we need every single kilowatt hour of energy we can get from any source. Hence, we're keeping the two last remaining nuclear power plants as a strategic reserve. But that doesn't change that we're phasing out nuclear and coal and all fossil fuel power generation in the medium term. In fact, we're even increasing the speed of our energy transition to get away from fossil fuels, which in our opinion is key both for fighting climate change and increasing our energy security.
Before now, had geopolitical risk been a consideration for clean energy transitions, and do other countries now need to ensure a level of self-sufficiency that perhaps they hadn't needed to consider before?
Well, from a German perspective, self-sufficiency with regard to energy was and will remain unrealistic. We know we will remain an importer of energy. We will discontinue importing fossil fuels, but we will import renewable hydrogen, for example. And what's really important now is diversification of energy imports and also building up the supply chains, which we need for building up the renewable energy infrastructure we need all around the world. So we need the capacities to build solar panels, to build windmills, to build electrolyzers for producing hydrogen. And we need many of those wherever we can build them. So getting these supply chains up and running and diversifying energy imports, which become renewable, these are the two key aspects.
With winter on the horizon, Germany must find ways to heat their homes and keep businesses going while still promoting renewable energy, as you're saying, and discouraging consumption. How difficult will this be?
At the moment, we're quite optimistic that we can get through the winter without any energy shortages. Our gas storages are filled to 90% right now, and they on their own can keep us running for almost 2 months. We still have half of our gas supplies coming from places other than Russia, Netherlands, Norway, and recently increasing LNG imports from the United States. At the same time, we're doing all we can to increase energy efficiency and decrease energy demand. Skyrocketing energy prices do their bit to achieve that, but we also have tough regulations in place for this winter, for example, regarding maximum temperatures in office buildings, regarding outside lighting. So we're really doing what we can, but knock on wood, being optimistic.
Your biography leads me to believe that a portion of your research deals with human behavior and decision making, which is a crucial element when energy policies will change how people live and how they feel about their history and their place in the world. I mean, energy impacts everything. So, for example, Politico published an article this week called "The Death of Das Auto: Can German Cars Survive the End of the Engine?" which I think is just one example of cultural identity as it relates to energy. In here in America, we have, you know, our trucks and our farming and our, you know, the long road and how we like to get around. How does one motivate the average person to embrace the changes that are coming and not be fearful of the change?
It's really important to take everyone on board with the energy transition. And to achieve that, first thing, the numbers need to be right. So it needs to be beneficial for every individual household and business to choose renewable technologies, to choose electric cars over fossil fuel powered cars. But people usually don't make very rational calculations about that. They talk to their friends, they see what others do. So what's really key is to spread the word, to share experiences between people so they learn from each other. And then when it comes to making the decision, you need to make it as easy as possible for individuals to actually make the right decision. So take psychology into account. People are not wholly rational utility maximizers, as some economists like to imagine them. They do what others do around them. So once you convince like some first movers, they'll spread the word and you see a dynamic that accelerates very quickly. So sometimes it seems hard in the beginning, but then change starts happening and things start moving very quickly.
So there's a little bit of peer pressure involved here.
Definitely.
Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz announced this week that Minnesota will join with 6 other Midwestern states to develop hydrogen as a clean energy economic opportunity. How important is hydrogen to the future of clean energy?
Hydrogen is really a key part of the solution for decarbonization. What we try to do in Germany is we try to electrify as much of the economy as we can. So ramping up renewable electricity, then electrifying home heating, electrifying transport in form of electric cars. But for some sectors, we just can't do that. When you think of heavy industry, steel industry, for example, when you think of trucking over long distances, when you think of shipping, aviation, you need solutions other than electricity and heavy batteries for that. So that's where hydrogen comes into the picture. And the nice thing is you can produce hydrogen from renewable electricity. So hydrogen is really the part that connects the renewable energy revolution with these hard-to-abate sectors. So it's really key to move quickly on the hydrogen front as well. So it's really exciting to see what's taking place here in Minnesota and the surrounding states with regard to that.
One last question before we go. Are you optimistic that industrialized nations can work together to reach the goal of net zero carbon by 2050?
I am. And the reason is simple. For a long time, we discussed reaching the climate targets in terms of making sacrifices, but that has completely changed. Now we see that switching to renewables is actually a win-win situation. We decarbonize and do something good for the climate while actually doing something good for the economy, creating jobs and increasing our welfare at the same time. And countries all around the world are realizing that right now. So we'll see a very fast uptake of all of these technologies, which started slowly, but now we're really at the beginning of a revolution, and the industrialized countries are the front runners, and all the others are very quick to catch up. So I'm optimistic.
Dr. Florian Knobloch, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Following the interview, Dr. Knobloch furthered the partnership between Minnesota and Germany by participating in a panel discussion with members of the Minnesota legislature about Germany's transition to clean energy.
So, what's happening is that this month in September, the government will pay out 300 euros as a lump sum payment to every citizen in Germany, but that's only a start that will realistically cover additional energy costs from 1 or 2 months in the winter.
What is your concern about the inflationary spiral that those kind of increases will create across your nation?
In the medium and long term, I think getting away from fossil fuels is actually part of the solution, as it decreases our reliance on price fluctuations for fossil fuel imports, which are now part of the problem. But you're also right that having all these investments now taking place can lead to some supply constraints. So it's quite important to make sure that we expand production capacities within our economy.
As we move towards electrification, and I saw just a week or two ago here, California was ahead of the other states in the country, got about 1 million electric cars or something, and they had a big alert out over the Labor Day weekend, I think, that don't plug your car in. We don't have enough power.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't electrify 1 million cars, how are you going to electrify 30 million of them? I mean, I just think we have a serious supply chain problem, not only on generation capacity. I mean, our grid here is stressed. I just got a load control message from my electric co-op here. So I got one yesterday. I got a winter place out west. I got one yesterday from them. They called me, texted me that you can't use power during these hours, right? I mean, as we move towards, and I'm not against electric cars, I just figure we got to figure out the whole chain so that people can plug them in and move around. Or we're going to decide we're just not going to travel anymore, right? That, you know, maybe we're just not going to move around. We're going to go to work and that's it. But, and then you got the whole supply chain issue of the batteries, the steel, the copper, the lithium, the cobalt, everything that goes into electrifying. We don't have the supply chain to manage all that.
What really matters is how you set up your grid. So actually having many electric cars around can be both a burden and part of the solution. Once you have smart grids where electric cars with their batteries also serve as electricity storage to balance the grid. We don't have that right now, but it needs to happen in the future. So we both have all these electric cars coming onto the street, and we have the problem of grid balancing. So that can go hand in hand. You have 1 million cars in California. You have 1 million free batteries for short-term electricity storage standing around, and cars stand around most of the day. So when you make sure they're connected to the grid while they're parked, and there's a smart system to charge and uncharge them when needed, that will go a long way.
A key Senate committee met to review the size and scope of the Department of Human Services following a recent audit criticizing the oversight of grants for homelessness and housing.
You have done some really straightforward work, particularly at the assistant commissioner level and above. But you and I had talked about compaction layer early on, and for those who aren't in ag, you develop a compaction layer when you drive over a field time and time and time again. And you keep planting seeds and you keep harvesting, but eventually that compaction layer gets in the way of roots going down. And so you never, plants appear healthy and then they end up with shallow roots. The transformative work that you are trying to do, Commissioner, has a compaction layer, and you're not going to fundamentally change the department until you get through that layer. And this report tells me the compaction layer is still in place. And maybe some of these systems will make that change, perhaps. Both Senator Abler and I have carried legislation to break up DHS because I'm getting this sense after 12 years that the cultural change that needs to happen where accountability and delivery are balanced is only going to happen if there's some fundamental change at DHS. And so I think the next legislature needs to seriously weigh what the structure of the Department of Human Services looks like.
I appreciate your comments about how the legislature has been generous in making sure that we had staff during COVID and often having staff as we ask for grants. But I do have to say my experience in the last 3 years is when we get down to the end of the session, very often DHS sacrifices the number of FTEs in their grant requests. We get the grant money, but not all the FTEs we originally said we needed to get the work done.
I heard you clearly. You know, we give you grant money, but then we don't give you staff. We expect you to do the same thing with the same amount of staff that you have as you're doing that. And if we really looked at, you know, the staffing needs of the department, right, how can we support the staffing needs? Are people doing what they should be doing? And that's what I think the commissioner has been trying to attempt to do. But getting to Senator Benson's point, it's not just that, but you got a cultural, historical entity that's been existence for, you know, many, many years. And you know, are we really questioning, are they doing what they should be doing?
And for each of the audits with findings that have been mentioned today over the years, we've had five strong audits in the same years. We've shared those for the last 3 years with our advisory panel because they never make the headlines. And so we've been able to share those with you in another way so you can see that we've also had really great audits in addition to some of the audits that have come across with findings.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.